Welcome back to the Why We Fight 1943 podcast, designed to accompany the social media series of the same name. I'm Sasha, and if you've listened to the previous episodes, you likely noticed that this one also started a little differently. Today's episode is about the Holocaust, and Dr. Benjamin Schneider does a wonderful job honoring this extremely important history. My guest today is Dr. Benjamin Schneider. Ben is an assistant professor in the Department of Military History at the Command and General Staff College at Fort Leavenworth in Kansas. Ben, welcome to the Why We Fight 1943 podcast.
Thanks so much for having me, Sasha.
Oh, I'm grateful you had the time to do this. So Ben, as much as I would love to only tell the stories about American soldiers kicking Nazi butt in World War II, it's time we did a Holocaust episode.
Well, I mean, it's the largest war in human history. If people are leaving happy and cheerful, you're not doing your job.
You know what? That's a very good point. So I am by no stretch of the imagination an expert on the Holocaust. We were just talking before the episode, and you mentioned that by the middle of 1943, the Holocaust is basically over. And that struck me as interesting because I've never heard that. And I had thought that it was something that lasted throughout the length of the war.
Yeah, so it's true. The process of the Holocaust will continue until the very final days of the war in 1945. But the majority of what the Germans set out to accomplish, the majority of the killing that goes on in the Holocaust has concluded by the middle of 1943. The most intense period of killing in the Holocaust occurs in 1942. That's when sort of what we associate with the Holocaust, the extermination camps, the death camps in Poland, are operating at sort of full tilt. By the time you get to the end of 1942, most of that has abated because most of the people there to be killed have been murdered. And so I guess it's probably worth talking about what we mean when we talk about the Holocaust and what we mean when we talk about what the Germans are setting out to do here and to set some of the parameters for your listeners. And so the term that the Germans talk about, right, is that this is the final solution to the Jewish question in Europe. And I'll take a minute to parse that. I think it's probably mostly self-explanatory, but there's a little bit of nuance that I think may be helpful for understanding why, by the time we get to 1943, this process has mostly been complete. So the Jewish question, right, is not a Nazi invention, right? This is a long-standing problem in European politics, which is what do European states do with the minority of their subjects that are Jewish, right? Because since the Middle Ages, most of these countries are explicitly Christian in their orientation and have often severe penalties, discrimination against religious and ethnic minorities. And the Jews are sort of the largest population group in many places that are out of step with the prevailing norms and attitudes, with the exception, of course, of, you know, the Protestant Catholic split by the time you get to the Reformation and all of that. But this question, as European states move into more nationalist, nation-state kind of frameworks by the 19th century, is what do you do with the section of your population that doesn't share your religion, that shares part but perhaps not all of your culture, and that traces their own history independent of the history of most of the people that live around them? And there is an increasing feeling in many places that for a nation state to function, you cannot have a large or perhaps any of the population sort of deviate from this national narrative, these national norms, this national culture, this national religion, that this represents a sort of a fractious group that can't be integrated or assimilated, and that in the case of the Jews, does not want to be integrated or assimilated necessarily fully into the lives of the people that live around. And so this is a consistent problem since the Jews arrive in Europe after the uprisings against the Romans. The initial diaspora takes place after the third Jewish revolt. Bar Kokhba tries to overthrow Roman rule. The Romans get real fed up with this, kill about 600,000 people, smash everything, and expel the survivors to the four corners of the earth. And so a number of Jews wind up in North Africa, they wind up in Europe, and are sort of forced to try to make their way in the world without a state or land. And then over the course of the period between the expulsion and the time we get to our story in World War II, the Jews have been sort of progressively pushed eastward. So initial Jewish communities, there are large Jewish communities in England, in Spain, in Germany, and over the course of sort of about the beginning of the Crusades out through, let's call it, Ferdinand and Isabel in 1492, there's this progressive series of expulsions as Jews are stripped of land and property and are told, you know, go somewhere else, we don't want you here. And by the time we get to the 20th century, most Jews have been pushed out of Western Europe entirely. There's only about 500,000 Jews in Germany at all. They're about 1% of the German population when the war starts. Almost all of Europe's Jewish population has been pushed into Poland and into Russia in what's called the Pale of Settlement. So there's this section on sort of the western periphery of Russia, Belarus, some of the Baltic states, sections of what are now Poland, called the Pale of Settlement, where Jews are required to live and are prohibited from living elsewhere. The problem of what to do with these people who are sort of not wanted and not allowed or interested in integrating becomes increasingly acute over the course of the 19th century. And so, you know, we sort of, now we think of German and German anti-Semitism as being sort of the showstopper, right? But if you were an observer looking at Europe in 1900, Germany would not stand out especially as a place that was unusually anti-Semitic for the time, right? France is being roiled by the Dreyfus Affair, and there's a question of the extent to which Jews who had been emancipated by Napoleon and given nominally full political rights can be integrated into the French nation. And in Russia, there are, over the end of the 19th century and into the early 20th, an increasingly violent series of pogroms that are going on, where Jews are Jewish property is destroyed, Jews are killed, Jews are sort of forced out of the country or forced into increasing poverty and precarity. This will, before the Second World War even begins, will result in the flight of 1 to 2 million Russian Jews from the European continent, many of those going to the United States during the period of open emigration or to other areas, sometimes Western Europe, sometimes elsewhere in the world. But so there is...
That's the basis for An American Tale, right?
Indeed, yeah. If you've seen if you've seen Fiddler on the Roof, or if you've watched An American Tale and its even more historically accurate sequel, Fievel Goes West, you are familiar with the basic outlines of this story, right? So you have all of these Russian Jews that flee to the United States. And in one of the many, many dark ironies of Jewish history, the fact that they are threatened, beaten, murdered, and expelled means that they will survive the Holocaust, where many of those who are better treated will not. And so as you move into the early to mid 20th century, there is this question, this Jewish question of what happens to this national minority in all of these different places. And as these Western nationalist governments, these European nationalist governments increasingly think that perhaps there is not a place for the Jews in the societies that they're trying to build, the Jews begin to wonder if maybe they're not right. And so Zionism will become an increasingly prominent position beginning in Eastern Europe and moving its way westward with Theodor Herzl, the Dreyfus Affair. And there will be sort of an open debate that is occurring about whether Jews can remain in Europe in any capacity that's being had on sort of both amongst Gentiles and amongst Jews. And so when the Nazis come onto the scene and start talking about a final solution to the Jewish question, this is what they're talking about. They're saying that the question of what do we do with our Jewish minority populations? How do they integrate into our societies? We have come up with an answer to this, and that is that we are going to make them cease to exist.
So you said by the time we get to the 20th century, Germany only has about 500,000, which is a really small percent of their overall population.
Yes.
But obviously they kill more than 500,000 Jews.
Yes.
So their Hitler's solution is a European-wide solution.
Yeah, so this is the Holocaust in the form that we think of it probably doesn't happen without the war. The Second World War creates the conditions, and it creates the conditions by creating a German empire in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
So initially, up through the 20s and 30s, the Nazis actually are not explicitly exterminationist. There's a debate within the Nazi Party about what should be done with the Jews. And so I think it's worthwhile here to take a moment just to talk a little bit about some of the ways in which Nazism and European anti-Semitism is changing in the 20th century, because this will also help make sense of some of this. So for most of European history, anti-Jewish prejudice is what I think is probably best referred to as anti-Judaism It is an objection to Jewish religious identity. Now, in the ancient world, right, this is also the case, right, but the particular complaints are about, you know, we have many gods, the Jews only have one god, we believe that, you know, sort of everyone can offer sacrifice to all of the gods, the Jews refuse to offer sacrifice to our gods like polite neighbors. You know, we have sort of Greek and Roman sexual practices are not considered acceptable under Judaism, and so there's a source of tension there. Mm-hmm. And so there is an active but not perhaps specific discrimination against Jews. Jews are seen as sort of being weird and uncouth and not like the people around them, and are on those grounds not especially liked. But it's not anything more than you would see necessarily towards any other sort of outsider culture. This really begins to change with the rise of Christianity in Western Europe. The problem of Judaism for Christianity is sort of twofold. The first of which, of course, right, is that Christianity begins as a Jewish sect, and so makes the claim that Jesus of Nazareth is the Messiah of the Jewish religion. And of course, the Jews, who continue to believe in sort of historical Judaism, do not accept that claim, right? And so you have this group of people who continues to exist who say, you know, no, actually, the sort of the founding narrative of your religion is not true. And whether they say that explicitly or whether they just kind of continue to go about their business, they are this dissident faction from the dominant narrative of the societies and cultures of Western Europe. But as time goes on, that tension, right, over what is fundamentally a religious dispute over whether Jesus is the Messiah, whether Jesus is divine, morphs as sort of the interpersonal contentiousness increases. And you can see even within the Gospels over the progression of time, right, the earlier Gospels are much less specific about who's responsible for the death of Jesus and sort of a shared blame. By the time you get to the later Gospels, it's much more, there's a tendency to refer to the Jews as a corporate body and to place blame for the crucifixion on the Jews in sort of a broad sense. And that's something that will be magnified and exacerbated, right? I'm not here to talk about the appropriate way to interpret Christian scripture. There are numerous different theological interpretations. The Catholic Church, most Christian denominations, would not endorse an anti-Semitic reading of the Gospels, and at this point that is very much a minority view. But there is a foundation in the text that is built on for much of this period, and which these passages are exaggerated, taken out of context perhaps, built into something bigger than they necessarily are, that forms a foundation of an anti-Jewish prejudice. And that's based on this initial claim of deicide, right? That the Jews particularly are responsible for Jesus' death in the way that other people are not. That the Jews killed God, and if the Jews killed God, then as of course time goes on, well, if they would kill God, then they might do all of these other terrible things like kidnap Christian children and use their blood in dark rituals. They might break into our churches and desecrate the communion wafers, right, which are transubstantiated to the body of God, and they want to go back and kill God again, and so on and so forth. So there is this long history of prejudice and conspiratorial thinking, but it's based in these religious complaints. And the thing about that is, for all of sort of the ugliness of it, is that you can escape it, right? A Jew can convert, can become a Christian, and can lose the stigma of being a Jew. And for most of European history, Jews are not inclined to do that, even though they are at legal disadvantage. But in the 15th century, with the Spanish Inquisition, you begin to see that start to change a little bit. And when Ferdinand and Isabella expel the Jews from Spain, there are a large number who convert, the conversos. And here we get the Spanish Inquisition, which is built on this concern, this fear that if you have these satanic Jews who engage in all these sort of dark and conspiratorial goings on, maybe they haven't genuinely converted. Maybe even if they say that they're good Christians now, maybe in their heart of hearts they're still Jews, and maybe they're still willing to engage in this sort of practice. And so this conspiratorial anti-Judaism continues to build over the course of the post-1500 period and into the 18th and 19th centuries, when you begin to see the rise of scientific racism. And as science advances and genetics begins to be increasingly well understood, and the belief that there are hereditary features of different groups of people and that there are these traits that are passed from generation to generation within these communities, and that those are no longer the outgrowth of culture or upbringing or religion, but are instead sort of inherent to the blood, right? That a person is what they are and cannot be anything else because they're shaped by their heredity. Anti-Judaism begins to morph into anti-Semitism, which is a racialized anti-Jewish prejudice. So the belief, by the time you get to the 19th century, becomes not, though anti-Judaism still exists, but not primarily in some of these sort of forward-thinking anti-Semitic circles, that the problem is the Jewish religion, the problem is the Jewish race. And so once you begin to think of the Jewish problem as a racial problem, right, and to think of all of these, again, these broad conspiratorial goings-on, which still have enormous power through this period, right, the idea of the scheming cabal of Jews who control the banks, who control the governments, who control culture, media, whatever else, this scheming, conniving Jew in the imagination of Europe, it begins to be seen not as a question of sort of the perfidy of Jewish religion, but instead the problem of Jewish essence. And that if all of these traits inhere in Jewish blood, then you have the question of, do you want them to assimilate? Because one of the things that begins to happen in Western Europe as Jews become, you know, sort of Jews in Eastern Europe are frequently extremely poor, marginal peasants, peddlers, etc., and generally keep and are kept to their own communities. In Western Europe, by the time you get to 18th, 19th, and 20th centuries, many Jews in those communities have begun to assimilate, who have begun to adopt less rigid religious restrictions, to engage more with people around them. And here's the big problem, have begun more and more to intermarry, right, into surrounding Gentile communities. And what that means, if you are a racial anti-Semite in the late 19th and early 20th century, is that all of those perfidious Jewish traits are now being introduced into the bloodline of your nation. And so you have the question then of what do you do with these people who are fundamentally inferior, who are fundamentally scheming and corrupt in the worldview of these bigots, and who are now able to spread that taint to those around them by intermarriage and assimilation, right? So now, right, you have the question of how do you deal with this population? And the Nazis, where they come in here, is increasingly it's believed in these right-wing, scientifically racist parties in Europe, right-wing parties in Europe, that the Jews can no longer remain, right? That they can't even be kept sort of inside purviews there. They can't be converted or assimilated, that these are fundamentally irreducible, and that they have to either be removed from the continent or they have to be dealt with otherwise. And so the Nazis into the 20s and 30s are arguing over which sort of vision they're going to pursue. And up into the middle 1930s, the Nazis are open to some degree the idea of expelling all the German Jews and to expelling Jews wherever else they might go from the continent. But you have two problems with this. The first of which is that the role that the Jew plays in the Nazi imagination is as this sort of puppet master, right? The Jews are in control of the Bolshevik Party. The Jews are behind communism. The Jews are sort of pulling the strings on, ironically, both left-wing politics, right, communist, but also international capitalism simultaneously. Very industrious people, the Jews, managing to control all of these political ideologies somehow simultaneously.
In secret,
right?
You know, right, because, you know, people are really good at keeping secrets.
Especially Jews, who are not apparently known for being voluble or talkative at all. So this is the challenge, right, of having all of this. The centrality of the Jew to the Nazi imagination means that you can't just kind of leave it sitting there. But you also deal with the other practical problem, which is, where do they go, right?
Yeah.
If you want to expel the Jews from Europe, they have to go somewhere. And that proves to be a problem because no one else wants them, right? The United States, up until the end of the First World War, has very loose immigration requirements. And so you have very large numbers of Jews that emigrate from Russia and the Pale of Settlement to America in the early 20th century. But after the end of the First World War, immigration restrictionists seize the upper hand in American politics. The Ku Klux Klan, which had gone from being a primarily anti-Black organization after the Civil War to being a much more diverse organization of bigotry, begins to inveigh against Jews and Catholics and immigrants from Eastern and Southern Europe. Jews, Italians emigrate in large numbers in the early 20th century, and so they get restrictions put in place, not the Klan specifically, but immigration restrictions. The Klan has a role in this. I think 5% of Americans are members of the Ku Klux Klan in the mid-1920s, which is sort of a staggering number.
Yeah.
They're very popular. They're very popular for a minute there.
Apparently.
But that means that the Jews...
They give you a toaster with membership?
A free toaster, yeah.
I'm just joking. Do you get like a free toaster with membership? Yeah. It's just hard. Like for me, you know, being left-leaning, very liberal, it's one of those things where it's like, I just can't imagine the amount of effort and energy that they put into hate.
Yeah, I mean, you get the robes too, I guess. And, you know, you can be a grand dragon or a wizard or something, which I suppose appeals to some people. But I think we forget how much scientific racism really was seen as new, as innovative, as progressive in many ways, as a modern scientific way of viewing the world. And that in many places, in Germany and the United States, it was educated professionals who were perhaps more inclined to adopt this sort of worldview, right? It's sort of now, you know, all of this stuff is seen as sort of... you know, a low class and a sort of the province of people who are, you know, not well educated, not the right sort of person. But in the early 20th century, it's very much the opposite.
Not quite as scientific as they thought.
As it turns out.
Funny how that works.
But the challenge then is, where else do they go, right? They can't go to the United States. They can't, other Western European countries don't generally have very open immigration policies at the best of times, and also have lingering or explicit anti-Jewish prejudices. And so as Hitler and the Nazis are trying to find a way to expel these people, they realize increasingly that there is nowhere to expel them to. And so by the time you reach 1939 and the invasion of Poland, the German government has mostly given up on the idea of pushing the Jews out and has instead begun to move towards keeping the Jews in, imposing their own restrictions on immigration, imposing stiff monetary penalties on Jews that try to leave. And then the war starts. And so you invade Poland, which adds 3 million Jews, and then you invade the Soviet Union in 1941, which has 2.5 million more. The Baltics have some, Southeastern Europe, Hungary, Romania have their own Jewish populations. And so where you had started with only 500,000 Jews under the control of Nazis, now, right, you have or are aspiring to have 11 million. And the question then becomes of how do you deal with having this large population within your borders or your desired borders that you do not want, that you do not believe can be assimilated, and that you cannot send anywhere else? Because if you thought it was hard to get rid of 500,000 German Jews to other countries, the idea that the United States or anyone else is simply going to take 11 million people out of the goodness of their hearts is a pipe dream. So the beginnings of a more radical interpretation of the solution to the Jewish question in Europe begins to unfold really after the invasion of Poland. And the thing I think that's important to understand is that now we tend to think of the Holocaust as being sort of this radical rupture in sort of how things had been done. And the idea now that you wouldn't see what was coming is crazy, right? That to see all of the groundwork being laid. But I think it's important to understand that up until you get to 1941 and 1942, and we'll talk about that in a minute, all of this is actually not all that unusual in the course of European or world history, right? That the Germans, the Nazis, will set in place the racial laws in 1934, which they very carefully model after American racial laws to prevent, right, a sort of criticism from coming from abroad. And those racial...
The Nuremberg laws?
Yeah, the Nuremberg laws. And...
With the journalists and the... Was it 1/16th, something like that, Jewish, and about owning businesses and different professions that they couldn't have anymore, which happened to be all professions that they were in. And
yeah, to remove Jews from cultural and economic life, to racialize Jews, right, to make people one Jewish grandparent, right, categorizes you. So you have sort of three categories: full Jews, Mischlinge Einsgrad, the first and second grade half breeds, degree half breeds. And of course, anyone who is a religious Jew of any stripe, regardless of sort of blood quantum, falls under the category. So there's still, again, remains this anti-religious prejudice along with the anti-racial one. But that, again, isn't enormously out of step, right? Many people see it as backwards and retrograde, right? You're going back to, you're either sort of adopting this American scientific racism, or you're going back to the medieval era where Jews are forced to wear distinctive markings or distinctive clothing so that they can be visually identified, restrictions on ability of Jews to marry non-Jews, restrictions on what professions or what kind of property or where and so on and so forth, is really just a return to the pre-Napoleonic era. And so for many people, right, and many Jews included, it's not great, but it also doesn't necessarily scream out, this is something new and terrifying, right? It is a reversion to something that had existed. That begins to change in Poland. Before I get ahead of myself, the one last thing I should point out is Kristallnacht, right? The pogrom that the SS and the Gestapo organized to destroy Jewish businesses. Even there, right, it's ugly, and people, even many Germans, denounce it, but it's not new. It's not a rupture, right? The Russians have been engaging in these sorts of pogroms. The Ukrainians have been engaging in these sorts of pogroms for years, decades now. And the one that transpires on Kristallnacht is neither unusual in terms of its scale and number of killed or the destruction and property that's been wreaked. So, again, none of it is ideal, but none of it screams out, this is something new and horrifying. And then you get to Poland, and you begin to see the stirrings of something darker. Poland represents the beginnings of sort of the racialization of the Nazi war effort, right? That when you annex Austria or Czechoslovakia, these are still Western Europeans, and there may be some Slavs living there, some what are seen as non-Aryan elements, but they're a minority of the population, and not a huge issue for the Nazi racial hierarchy. Poland is Polish, and Poles are seen in this sort of Nazi categorization scheme as not being Aryan and not being part of good and decent people. And so there is a... Right, if the goal is Lebensraum for the Germans, if it is space for Aryans to expand into for agriculture and other purposes, the Poles and the Jews are a problem that needs to be dealt with. And the initial, after the war concludes itself, there's this initial press, we need to make sure that there's not going to be an uprising or any effort to sort of undermine German government. So Polish intellectuals, Polish clergy, Jews of all stripes, communists, leftists, people who would be seen as opponents of the regime or a nucleus for any sort of resistance movement or Polish government are set out to be liquidated. And for the most part, this is restricted in its initial phases to adult males. They're not yet at the point where they're killing women and children in large numbers, but there is a systematic effort to begin shooting these people in by the tens of thousands. And the other thing that the German army begins to do, which they don't to the same degree in France, is reprisals, right? That as the Poles fight the war or fight partisan actions against the Germans, they begin to retaliate in wildly disproportionate ways. So, you know, one Polish person picks up a rifle and shoots a German soldier. The Germans take 500 people into the town square, shoot them, and then set every building in the town on fire. Right, that these are the kinds of reprisal actions that are undertaken on a regular basis and with the approval, in many cases, of Wehrmacht leadership and with the support and full participation of the average German soldier. But these begin to coalesce into the beginnings of a more systematic murder of Jews, right? Because in the Nazi mind, Jews are linked with communists, Jews are linked with their political opponents, Jews are those who pull the strings in international politics and therefore are also seen as the sort of the nucleus of the partisan movement. When reprisals aren't to be undertaken, the Jews form a natural target because they are seen as an inherently hostile force within Polish society. And so as you move through 1939 and into 1940, more and more reprisals, special actions against the Jews specifically begin to be undertaken. And this process begins to feed on itself as sort of the paranoia ramps up and intensifies. This is going to all come to a fever pitch with the invasion of Russia in 1941. It's a widening of the war. It's an expansion. Now, if the Germans thought they had a Jewish problem with the acquisition of half of Poland, now taking the other half of Poland plus the desired 2.5 million Jews in Russia, now you really have a question that you need to deal with. And you also have the World War, right? Because now this is no longer like we fought the French, we're kind of fighting the British. Like now the Americans are involved and the Americans are providing the Soviets with war material and it's going to be a thing. And so there's a famous quote where Adolf Hitler, or maybe it's Joseph Goebbels, before the war kicks off, says essentially that, if there is another world war, it will not, the Jews are trying to bring on this world war. If they do get their wish and this war happens, they're not going to get the destruction of the German people like they think they are. They're instead going to get their own annihilation. And on December 8th, 1941, after the United States enters the war and Hitler decides to declare war on Germany, he essentially says to his senior leadership, the world war is here, and the Jews are going to get what they asked for. When I prophesied that they would be annihilated at the end of it, I mean it, and that's we are going to sort of undertake this endeavor. He doesn't give an explicit how we're going to do that. He doesn't issue a written order or anything, but it is understood by all of his senior leadership that those processes that had sort of been in motion are now going to accelerate. And so after December of 1941, right, you get to sort of the battle for Moscow, and it becomes clear that the war is going to go for a while. These processes begin to be set in motion, right? The initial plan had been the war will be over quickly. We'll deal with the Jewish problem thoroughly once the war is over. We'll figure out what's going to happen. But now the war is going to go for a while, so you have to think about it. And so in January of 1942, the Wannsee Conference occurs, which is this meeting of senior German leadership to try to find a final solution to the Jewish question. And so you get at this conference a discussion of what is to be done specifically, I mean, broadly with all of the Jews in Europe, but perhaps most specifically what's to be done with the Jews in Poland, because this is where the problem is most pressing. Right? In Western Europe, Adolf Hitler is still, the Nazis are still hesitant to drop sort of the full force of the Nazi regime on Western European Jews. They're worried that this will spark some degree of backlash or resistance, and so they continue to press discriminatory measures, right, expropriation, forcing Jews into ghettos or other sort of undesirable living situations, possibly starvation in many cases. But they're still not ready to sort of reveal, to tip their full hand as to what they want to do in the West. In the East, they don't have that problem. The Polish government has been destroyed. The Poles themselves are going to be destroyed down the road. And so none of these people will serve as witnesses. And of course, Eastern Europe is much more virulently anti-Semitic than Western Europe is at this point. Many of these countries had their own violent anti-Jewish pogroms absent any German intervention. And so the Nazis, correctly, I think, anticipate that there will be less resistance to what they intend to do to the Jews in the East. And so they begin to start the process. And so the basic outcome of the Wannsee Conference is the architecture of the final solution, right? That they commit to the destruction of European Jewry, and they begin to outline how that process is going to occur. So up to this point, right, what's been going on has mostly been what's called the Holocaust by bullets, right? That this use of small arms, generally firing squads, mass graves, shooting people into ditches. And this has been used against Jews, against Polish partisans, against ethnic Poles, right? That this is sort of a multi-purpose tool that, as it turns out, you can shoot whoever you want at the back of the head.
But shooting is messy, and it's also expensive. But, I mean, to ask your soldiers to consistently line up people and just shoot them, these are not soldiers that they're shooting. These are regular people.
Yeah. And that it ultimately, all of the objections that you've just raised are the ones that lead them to start thinking about other solutions, other techniques. Because as you say, it is slow, it's time consuming. Those who don't have any scruples about it will sort of write their superiors and say, you know, our unit shot 75,000 Jews, and that's a drop in the bucket to what needs to be done here. This is not going fast enough to be able to accomplish the task at hand. The men in those units, there are varied responses, right? There are some real psychopaths for whom this is not troubling at all. There are many people.
It's a mixed bag.
Yeah. But you do begin to see a spike in alcoholism and suicide in some of these units. As it turns out, again, killing women and children at, you know, point blank range. The 8mm Mauser does some pretty horrific things to the human body. And when you're standing on piles of blood and brain and bone for 12 hours a day, guys begin to lose it a little bit. So there's an effort to shunt some of this off onto local forces, Ukrainians, Lithuanians, Poles, whoever else can be sort of found to do the dirty business. But even there, it's...
Outsourcing,
yeah. But it's not... That's right. Cheap contractors, And we laugh because you can't really do anything else given how bleak this is, but it's not entirely wrong, right? That there is in many cases an economic component to this, that many Eastern European Jews are dirt poor, but then so are many Eastern Europeans. And those Jews that do have some degree of property, that property can be seized and distributed. And so for the people that live in these areas, if your Jewish neighbors are unceremoniously shot and dumped in a mass grave, that means that you can have their house, you can have their cow, you can have their apartment, you can have their business, you can have whatever they've got lying around. And so whether or not these people hate Jews per se, there is very little incentive to do anything about this and much incentive to be involved with the process. But the problem becomes that this is an enormous sink of manpower and materiel. It's time consuming and it's not going to work fast enough, which means that they need another method to do this. And they are fortunate in trying to figure this out that they've also been coming up with ways to mass murder other groups of people. And so one of the other groups...
I was like, been looking at ways to mass murder people. How convenient.
I know, right? It's right. It's almost as though when you really put your mind to it, right? And again, this is the nature of the Nazi regime, is that killing people is not an accidental part of this process. This is fundamental to what they want to do. And one of the groups of people that they want to exterminate are the disabled, those with the infirm, the elderly, those with mental or physical disabilities, children who are not seen as representing the strongest stock. They have this quasi-Spartan notion about improving the German race by sort of purging the bottom, 10% of children on some kind of weird strength metric.
Homosexuals too, right?
Yes. So homosexuals are there, though interestingly enough, are not actually usually specifically targeted. The number of homosexuals that are killed as homosexuals during the course of the war is about 10,000. Most homosexuals who are going to be killed are going to be killed as part of another group, because they're Soviet prisoners of war, because they're Jewish, because they're Polish. The Germans are not as thorough on that front, and there are at times willingness to tolerate people who have those proclivities if they are good Nazis. So I'm blanking on his name right at this moment, but the head of the Sturmabteilung, the brown shirts, Ernst Röhm, is known as a homosexual and is in charge of the brown shirts up until the night of the long knives in 1934, when he will be purged in part as a part of the power struggle with the SS, right? But his proclivities are sort of hidden and indulged because he is a strong party member. But in the abstract, at least, these kind of tendencies are to be eliminated from a proper Aryan Nazi Reich. make. They just haven't gotten around to doing it in a thorough fashion yet. There are any number of groups that are on the Nazi to-do list that they don't get to before the end of the war. But so the disabled and the infirm, right, they do start to begin to figure out ways to deal with. They want to dispose of these people who are in insane asylums, who are in on government benefits, who are seeing life unworthy of life is the term that is used. And so they begin sort of quietly. The medical establishment is, like I said, Nazism is very much a popular ideology in the legal professional circles, doctors no less than anyone else. And so there are many German doctors who are on board with the program and who begin to start talking about different ways to euthanize is the polite term, but to murder these people. And as this goes along, again, the volume continues to go up. And so someone has the bright idea. They can't kill these people for the most part in the asylums where they are in the local facilities. They need to be taken somewhere else and disposed of. And if we're going to put all these people in a truck anyway and take them out to some far-flung place to bury the bodies, what if we just pipe the exhaust into the back of the truck and then asphyxiated them on their way? And so these mobile gas vans will be a tool that is increasingly used for killing these undesirables. Interestingly enough, actually, this program is, a wrench is thrown into the program when the Catholic Church gets wind of it. And the Catholic Church, they've come to their own sort of uneasy accommodation with the Nazi government, but have sort of a diffident relationship with Germany's Jewish population or the Jewish population of Europe, but are very staunch in their opposition to euthanasia and eugenics. They're not joking about that. And so as this action that is underway against the disabled and the infirm begins to pick up, the Catholic Church, German Catholic bishops begin to start preaching from the pulpit about what's going on. They get reports from people about the killings taking place, and they begin to preach against what's going on. And it finally becomes enough of a public stink that Hitler and the Nazi government are forced to sort of back away from it for a little bit. But just in time to free up all of those specialists that they have who are trained in gassing people so that they can begin to go to the east and so that they can begin to use mobile gas vans in Poland against Poles and Jews and others. And then the question comes up, well, these gas vans have been pretty effective, right? They don't have the problem of bullets. They don't have the problem of being as messy and as upsetting for the people who are in charge of doing the killing. What if we set up centers, places to send people where they could be gassed in large numbers, industrial hubs for murder? And so this leads to, in 1942, the development of the Aktion Reinhardt camps, right? Sobibor, Belzec, Treblinka, which are created essentially to exterminate Polish Jewry. These are death camps. There's no labor component to them. There is no place for holding political prisoners. There's no other element to it. It is simply a place where Jews will be sent and exterminated. And this serves sort of two purposes. The first one of these purposes is that you eliminate Polish Jewry, which is something that you have to do. But it also begins to free up space in the ghettos of Eastern Europe. Because now, as the trajectory of the Final Solution has moved fixated on extermination, it's been decided that the Jews of Western Europe, of course, are also going to suffer from the same fate. But of course, you don't want to start building these camps for the most part in Germany proper. Some are, but you prefer to have extermination camps in sort of the Wild East. But you need some place to put these people while they're being staged, right, while they're waiting for their final fate. And so to clear out space in the ghettos, you need to kill the Polish Jews so that the Jews of Western Europe can be sent east to await what is eventually going to happen to them. And so over the course of 1942, these camps become operational and start fulfilling their mission, and more will be brought online, sort of hybrid camps, as it becomes clear that these death camps are not themselves enough to exterminate everyone. So Auschwitz-Birkenau will be one of the camps that is sort of a dual-purpose slave labor camp and extermination camp. And so the Jews of Poland will be sent to these camps to be destroyed. And that's exactly what will happen. And so you get the industrial process, right? Jews are deported from their villages, from the ghettos, often in sort of extremely brutal roundups. Children will be killed. Anyone who's not willing to leave will be shot. Rape, plunder are commonplace things. People will be put in train cars, cattle cars, right, without adequate ventilation, with no food or water for a week-long journey or more. It's not insulated in any way, so if you're sent in the winter, you freeze to death. If you're sent in the summer, you die of heat exhaustion before you get there. And these sort of brutal actions will continue throughout, and so there will be shootings, murders, beatings, other incidental brutality as this sort of seemingly more cleanly process of mass murder begins. And so when we talk about the Holocaust being mostly over by the time we get to 1943, it's to say that these camps work extremely efficiently for the job that they've been set out to do. And that by the time you get to the middle of 1943, about 90% of the Jews of Poland will have been murdered. And most of those who have not been murdered are not formally alive at all. They're hiding with Gentile neighbors. They've moved to the forests and joined partisan groups. They're living under assumed identities. They've fled for other countries. Only a small number have been kept alive in any formal capacity by the Nazi government. And so, in fact, when you get to the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising, right, in the spring of 1943, what happens to the ghetto is, I mean, a rearguard action is giving entirely too much dignity. What it is that the last Jews of Poland have decided to die with weapons in their hands rather than go meekly to the extermination camps. The Warsaw Ghetto, Warsaw itself had been a third Jewish prior to the Nazi invasion. About 500,000 Jews will be crammed into the ghetto in Warsaw. Space that's about a third of the city is crammed into, more than a third of the city is crammed into 2.5% of the city's overall space. 10, 15 people to the room, starvation rations given out, 500 calories a day, mass starvation, mass immiseration. And beginning in late 1942, early 1943, the mass deportations, about 250,000 Jews will be deported to the extermination camps, will be fed into the furnaces at Treblinka, at Belzec, at Sobibor. And when you get down to the last 70 or so thousand, less than that, I think, you get a few very small resistance movements. The Jewish Combat Organization, which is the left-leaning guerrilla group that's managed to scrape together some guns. There's a group organized out of Beitar, which is the right-wing nationalist paramilitary organization organized by sort of the hard right Zionist Vladimir Jabotinsky. They'll put together a few hundred fighters, and then when one of these deportation actions is going on, they will arrange a few guys with pistols will shoot the Germans as they're trying to get Jews on the train to deport them. And this will feed into Heinrich Himmler's paranoia, his idea that the Jews are behind all the partisan movements, that these people are a threat. And so when he orders the ghetto and all the ghettos liquidated, he sends in the SS, the Waffen-SS, to raise the ghetto to the ground. And so there will be a month-long battle beginning in April of 1943 on the eve of Passover, where the Germans will enter the ghetto and about 700 Jewish fighters will take to the streets to try to, I mean, delay the inevitable is really the wrong word. Everyone knows what's going to happen, but to die with weapons in their hands and to take as many Germans with them as they can. It won't work particularly well. About 40,000 Jews will be deported to the camps anyway. About 7,000 will be killed. In the course of fighting, the SS will proceed to burn the buildings down block by block, street by street, to level the entirety of the ghetto. And about 7,000 people who had managed to hide out will be found in the days afterwards and will be either sent to the extermination camps to be dealt with that way or will be simply shot out of hand. Only a very small handful of people will manage to escape from the Warsaw Ghetto to get false or assumed papers to hide with their Gentile neighbors for any length of time or to meet up with the Polish Home Army and the resistance there. And really this will be the end, in many ways, of Polish Jewry. The Jodz Ghetto holds out into 1944, I believe, but basically everyone, all the Jews of Poland, are annihilated by the end of 1943. Poland had, at the beginning of the war, a Jewish population of 3 million. It was one of the centers of Jewish culture in the world. Today, it has 35,000 Jews.
80 years later, and 35,000 is all they've got.
I think that one of the things that people don't understand about the Holocaust is that in a very real way, Hitler won. European Jewry was destroyed, that those Jews who survived the extermination process leave, if not immediately, then over time, that the Jews of Western Europe were never a large number to begin with. Most of them will depart. Jews of Eastern Europe, those that survive, will not want to return under Soviet domination or to neighbors and places that had not been particularly kind to them before they left and had been proved not to be particularly kind after they tried to return. And indeed, there would be anti-Jewish pogroms and lynchings after survivors of the Holocaust would return to Poland, Lithuania, to Estonia, to parts in the East. And so the Jews of Europe would leave, either for generally the United States or after 1947, 1948 for British Mandate Palestine, and then eventually the State of Israel. And again, Europe, which had been for two millennia a center of Jewish learning and Jewish culture, where Jews had contributed to sciences and to the arts, to theology, culture, poetry, music, would cease to exist and has ceased to exist in any real way. And that's what I got for you.
It's great.
I hope everyone's feeling real happy and uplifted. It's a good note to start your day on.
Wow. I don't think that I realized that it was still, that the population was still so small.
Yeah. It's.
I would not want to go back. If it was me and that was what had happened, I would not want to go back. I wouldn't. I can see the families not wanting to go back. The families that survived. It's pretty awful.
Yeah, I know people who had gotten out. A roommate of mine, his grandparents had been lucky. They had been German Jews, and they had been able to escape on the Kinder transport in the early 30s before the immigration restrictions really took effect, and they went to England, and most of their family, their extended family, was annihilated, and they would not speak German. They would not buy anything of German origin. They would never go back. The old world was dead to them. There was nothing left for them there.
It's definitely awful. But these are the stories that we need. I mean, we need to know these stories. I know that when the first series that I started doing, when I started it, it did start out as a focus on Army history, but the series has morphed because we can't just look at military history in isolation. We have to look at everything else that was going on, and we can't just look at, you know, the battles between the U.S. Army and the Allies and the German and Italian forces. We have to look at everything else that was going on to get the full picture, and I think that that's, I'm really grateful that you were able to come on and do this episode because it's something that I don't think that I know I definitely don't have the knowledge to do it myself.
So I think it's an interesting point you raised there, and I'll emphasize this. I know we're starting to wrap up here, but I think this is a worthwhile point to raise. The other thing that I think is really important to understand about this, and this is sometimes, you know, I teach Army officers, and sometimes you get questions on this front, you know. I think it's really essential to understand that in many ways, the Holocaust is the purpose of the war for Germany. That this is not a sideshow. This is not something that they kind of get distracted by. This is one of the core political and military objectives that they're fighting for. And so when people will ask sometimes, you know, well, what if the Germans had, you know, hadn't had such a heavy hand? What if they hadn't put their resources into this? What if they had tried to sort of liberate Eastern Europe from communism and tried to, you know, be greeted as liberators rather than as sort of the hard-handed tyrants that they were. And that's a really interesting counterfactual, but the problem with that is that then they wouldn't be the Nazis, right? That this kind of war is the kind of war that they were intending to fight. That the destruction of the Jews was the prelude, but the depopulation of Eastern Europe and its resettlement by an ethnic German population was the stated, explicit goal and intent. And this race war that Adolf Hitler and his lunatic colleagues concocted in their minds is the reason for the battles and for the fighting. And it is this machinery, this architecture that they are fighting to expand and in many ways to protect. And I think that it can't be separated, that this is, if you want to understand why the German army acts the way it acts, does what it does, fights the way it fights, goes where it goes, this is it, right? This is the vision of the world that Nazism fought for. As much as it's more fun to talk about, you know, Tiger and Panther tanks and the exciting things that Stukas can do, this is the purpose of all of it. So
thank you. No, I really, this is a really important episode, and I feel like this is a good time for it because we can pace it with mm-hmm. the content, but it's something that I have not really covered throughout the first two series. And now we're getting into this third year of, third year for me. You know, the first series, mm-hmm. I focused on 1939 to 1941, but it was mostly just the U.S. Army and it was stateside, mm-hmm. you know, so then 1942 and 11 months out of that, 10 months out of that year, we're just preparing. We're preparing to fight mm-hmm. a little bit in the Pacific, but, you know, I'm focused more on North Africa and when we get there. So it's slow, you know, it seems slow. And now we're here in 1943 mm-hmm. and it's like, I have barely touched on things like, what are we even doing? You know, what are we fighting against? What are we preventing or trying to prevent or stop? Mm-hmm. And the fact that, I mean, everything takes so long and probably longer in 1943 than it would now, but it's, this was an important episode, and I'm really, really grateful that you took the time to help educate me and help explain these stories so that I understand it better as I'm going forward with the series, but also so the audience can better understand what the Holocaust mm-hmm. actually was and what, what we're looking at now.
Yeah, I'm glad to be able to do it, and I hope that your listeners find it to be helpful and informative. I think that it is, it is in many ways one of the key stories of the war. I think it's one of the enduring stories of the war. You know, it's interesting. Occasionally I get people who will ask me sort of, you know, why is there so much focus on the Holocaust, you know, that terrible things sort of happen all times and all places, you know, that why is it that this seems to get so much attention? And some of that, of course, is as you alluded to, right, that, you know, here in the United States, there's this question in many ways for much of the war, sort of, what is it about? Why are we involved in this conflict between European countries that we don't necessarily seemingly have any inherent interest in, right? You know, to many Americans up through the for most of the war, right, are not necessarily enamored of the idea of fighting to help the British Empire or to help the French or whoever else. You know, of course, as Americans, once the camps are liberated and it's clear what the nature of it is that we were fighting has been, it answers a lot of those questions. And so I think, understandably, Americans who had family members who fought, who suffered, who died in the war and want to understand why that was and whether it was worth it, gravitate to the story of the Holocaust. But I think the other piece of it is perhaps that its most enduring legacy, you know, one of the things about the Holocaust, right, is that, and I alluded to this earlier, is that Germany was in many ways the last place that anyone would have thought that this would have transpired. Germany was seen as being on the cutting edge of science, the cutting edge of culture, a civilized place with decent, civilized people. And in many ways, the reason the Holocaust is as horrific as it is because precisely of that. Right, that the reason that the Holocaust continues to horrify and to fascinate and to be the center, I think, of so much of this attention is that we have built in the modern era political organizations, states that are capable of mobilizing enormous resources, generating enormous quantities of materiel, of weapons, of organizing violence on a scale and capacity that has never before been known in human history. And the Holocaust is, I think, the purest distillation of what a state is capable of doing if it decides to set that organized violence to the purposes of exterminating a group of people. And the reason that this is something that is perhaps worth looking at for the continuing future is that it remains a cautionary tale about what we are capable of, about what the states and systems that we've built are capable of, if the wrong people take control of them, and about the kinds of things that we ourselves may find ourselves complicit in if we are not constantly on our guard. I think that very few people in Germany in 1935 understood what it was that they were going to take part in by the time 1945 rolled around. And yet there they were. And that's where they found themselves in. So
anyway. It's definitely important. And there are a lot of people who I work with somebody who's constantly telling me how much he hates history. And I said, do you hate history? He goes, it's boring. He goes, it's boring. And I don't care about the people or the names or the dates. It's like, that's all history is. That's not what history is, you know? And so at some point, maybe I'll convert him into somebody that actually likes history. I do try to make this as digestible as possible, even when they're horrible topics like this one. But you, the way that you present it is, I don't want to say digestible because it's an awful lot, but considering how much we covered in this, give or take an hour, and how difficult these topics are, I feel like I couldn't have asked for a better guest, Ben. So I really appreciate that you taking the time.
Thank you so much. Anytime, just let me know. I'm happy to come on and help you with whatever you need.
Well, I've definitely got you on my list.
All right. Well, thanks so much. Thanks so much for having me on. And again, just let me know.
Thanks again, Ben. And thank you all for joining us today. Just a reminder that any views and opinions expressed are those of the speakers and do not reflect any official stances of the U.S. Army, the Combined Arms Center, the Center of Military History, the Command and General Staff College, the DoD, or any other organization associated with me, my guests, or this series. Be sure to check out the Why We Fight 1943 series content on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube, as well as this podcast, all of which will run throughout the year. Until next time, MOT out.